I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here today with us. We have Brian Goldman, Dr. Brian Goldman, here to talk about his new book, The Power of Kindness, Why Empathy is Essential in Everyday Life. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be speaking with you, David.
So tell me, what is white coat black art?
White coat black art began as a book that was originally, and in fact, a show concept that was originally entitled Medical BS.
Okay. All right.
So
let's get that out of the gate. Yeah,
let's get that right out of the gate. Yeah, basically, it was about it. The concept behind the show, behind White Coat Black Art, is the disconnect. It started as pulling back the curtain and revealing the innermost thoughts of health professionals and what really is going on in the culture of modern medicine. And, you know, from a physician point of view, but also including nurses, paramedics, social workers, and all other, you know, allied health professionals.
Sure.
Depending on whether we see them as we, the larger we, us and them, and, you know, the us and them shenanigans that can go on in inside the sliding doors of the hospital. And so the whole concept behind medical BS was the disconnect between what health professionals tell patients very earnestly, or what they say in public, you know, when they're being quoted in the media, and what they say to each other. And I wanted to be able to reveal what they really mean when they utter medical BS, and you know, things that they know or believe to not be true.
Well, so give me a good example of medical BS.
Okay, so an example of medical BS is you know, the influenza vaccine is a highly effective vaccine, and it's to say that the influenza vaccine is the most effective way of preventing the flu, which may be true, but it's missing the fact that from year to year the effectiveness varies, and it
right.
can be as low as 15% or 10%, which is not very effective at all.
Right.
So,
right.
but when you say that it's the most effective, that's a relative as opposed to an absolute
sure.
benefit, and you know, or for instance, you know, when a pharmaceutical company says that their wonder drug can reduce the risk of dying as a complication of a disease by 50%. And what they mean is it can reduce the number of deaths from two patients per million sufferers to one patient per million sufferer.
Right.
And that's a 50%
sure,
reduction,
sure,
but as
is,
a
yeah.
but as an absolute reduction, it's utterly meaningless.
Yeah, when you drill down to the numbers, not sounding quite as impressive.
And so you know, my and that's what the show is all about, and it has evolved. You know, originally it was telling stories mostly from the perspective of health professionals, and you know, people enjoyed that. People were saying, wow, I've never heard this before, but it has morphed into talking about the patient's experience, or the experience of patients and families within the culture of modern medicine.
Well,
that
and,
way you get both of them.
Well, and what I love about just the way you've described it is it sounds digitally empathetic. Does that make sense? Like, here you are presenting this show online for people to listen to, blogs, podcasts, writing, and through a digital meeting, and yet with this empathetic edge. Because it's about listening, really, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
and that's my whole. I mean, that's how I connect with people I interview, and that's my stock in trade. And you know, whether I'm doing interviews in the studio or field producing interviews, you know, I want to really understand people, and I want to connect with them. And I would say that I found a kindred spirit in Alan Alda, who was on our show earlier this season.
Oh, wow.
And he wrote, you know, he wrote this wonderful book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? And his whole thing is connecting with people, engaging people,
right.
and relating to them, as they call it in acting. And in fact, you know, for me, when I interviewed him, the challenge was, you know, would he just see me as another interview, you know, who's people, someone who's mining for some original quotes and stories that have never been told before,
right.
or would we be
the
able to find
scoop.
A way of connecting? And so I read his book. You know, I read it carefully, and I don't just read information. I'm putting two and two together,
making connections.
Exactly, and my book, and that's what my book is about. Not just profiling some of the kindest people on the planet, but trying to figure out on some level what makes them tick.
For me, one of the threads in your book is, and by the way, congratulations. What a great title. I love the starting point. I love the presupposition. I love the also. I need to do a little shout out here. The philosopher in me. You open up, you know, much like the road less traveled, with this wonderful question or statement. You say, "Am I a kind soul?" As an existential question, it's right up there with "Why do I exist?" I mean, this appeals to, as my listeners will know, this appeals to the philosopher in me. The Socratic edge comes out. You've tipped your hat right out of the gate on the book. And I love that. And but for me, the thread is that every story, every person matters. That's kind of what one of the takeaways for me.
Well, I'm glad that that's what you're taking away from it, because that's certainly the thing that, you know, all in the arc of my own life, my own professional and personal life, that is the most important thing. And whether it's somebody who has an interesting background because they've accomplished a lot and they've been lauded and praised and people, you know, quote them in the media and follow their every move, or whether it's a homeless person who has a story to tell about you know, the final break from their family of origin, and often it's not a pretty moment. But you know, certainly when I got into documentary production 30 years ago, it was clear that the, you know, my mentors taught me well. They taught me that everybody has a story to tell, and you just have to sit and listen to it, and you'll find out what it is. You empathizing with other people was certainly part of my journey. I knew I used it. One of the things I wanted to find out was am I still a kind person?
Right, right. And yeah, so tell us a little bit about that journey. So were you, I guess maybe the other question I can ask, or another question to ask, is were you a kind soul? So is there a before and after here?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. And I would say that now, then, and for the rest of my life, I will vacillate back and forth from I am kind to I'm not kind. And that's part of, you know, what makes me run. You know, that's what makes me roll. I am motivated. One of the things I discovered in that, you know, before the book, but also it was, you know, my understanding of myself was solidified during the research for the book. A couple of things, I guess, that we present different sides of ourselves to different people at different times, and some of those sides are kind, and some of them aren't. And you know, sometimes I'm motivated by a desire to truly connect and understand, and other times I'm motivated by a desire to feather my nest and get the story, get the interview, get that original really interesting thing, and sometimes I'm really connecting with the other person, and I'm really worried about what's going to happen to them. And I want to protect them. And other times, I don't feel that way at all. And it depends on whether I'm working in the emergency department or with my, you know, with my immediate family, with my partner Tamara's family, which is a different tribe.
Right.
And you know, whether I'm in a social group, whether I'm supposed to be having a good time, or whether I'm not supposed to be having a good time, whether I'm faking that I'm having a good time, so that I'm one of the most important things I learned is that at all times at the highest levels of executive function, empathy is a choice. Kindness is a choice. It's never an imperative. And if someone tells me it's always an imperative, then I'm thinking they're a martyr.
So do we choose to empathize because it's going to benefit us? I mean, you know, you say there's, I kind of went to the Jekyll and Hyde. I mean, we love to polarize, right? We really do. I mean, even, you know, those of us who say we're inclusive and are willing to listen, we still like to compartmentalize and put people into boxes and labels and label things. Is that a problem for empathy and for your project, you know, pushing towards kindness, a more kinder world?
The short answer is that it could be a problem. It's a problem, I think. You know, I don't think it's a problem if you're doing things, you're constantly doing things that are universally considered good. And you know, in general, we are hardwired to be empathic and kind because it's pro-social, because it makes the world a better place. And at its most elemental, we wouldn't be raising our children if we'd be abandoning our children.
Right.
Instead, we bond to them almost instantly. And if you were to do a functional MRI of my brain and you know, my child's brain, when we're really connecting with one another, when we're clicking, then we might very well, you know, the same centers of our two brains are lighting up at the same time. Certainly, that's the case with mom and newborn baby. But There's the tension between that urge to be kind and connect with other people, and that other, and that's probably a higher level function, and then that other more primitive part of our brain that cannot resist under certain conditions separating ourselves into us and them, or ourselves and the other. And you know, certainly you have seen that, particularly in the United States these days, and
right.
You know, certain countries in the EU that have been electing leaders that are nationalist. You know, and nationalist to me is code for the big us and you them and you're not us, and that's why we have to erect borders and build walls as Donald Trump has talked about. In the United States, and by the way, it's not just what he's saying. He's just symbolizing it. It's what people in the United States are saying, and you know, frankly, I worry about it, and I think us and them is in its ascendancy right now. You know, and so that's some of the bigger picture tension. Us and them versus our desire to be kind. Then there's also you raised a really interesting question, and that is, why am I kind? If I am a kind soul, or am I truly a kind soul, or am I simply trying to garner a reputation for kindness?
Right. I'm working the system.
I'm working the system, so people are going to say Brad Bryan's a really kind guy.
Yeah.
And you know. That opens up a lot of possibilities. You know, one of them is that I could be kind for the sake of solidifying my sense of superiority over somebody else.
Yeah, it's kind of, is there any such thing as a purely unselfish act, I suppose, you know, would be a similar question.
Oh, I think, yeah, and I think there is. You know, I'm walking across, I fantasized about walking across a street and with my daughter and not seeing the car coming and pushing her out of the way and taking the blow myself and I would do that in a heartbeat.
I love how you say, this is going to stay with me, Brian, and thanks for that. We bond with our children. We don't abandon them. I mean, if that's not a predisposition towards inclusion, I'm not sure what is.
Yeah, and it's not always easy.
So let's just agree. We know this to be true, most of us, let's say, globally. But do we actually practice it? You traveled the world on this one. You and I want to talk about neuroscience as well, and I want to touch on what robots had to teach you too. So there's lots to talk about. But yeah, we know this to be true. But why is it so hard to practice?
I think it's hard to practice because it depends on where you live. It depends on what your lifestyle is. I think that. There are, you know, for every individual, the factors that coalesce around, you know, are they net kind or net unkind? You know, do they use their powers of empathy or not? You know, they'll be as individual as you and I and everybody else who's listening to us having this conversation right now. But I think there are some common factors. Is meanness on the rise? I think it is. I think that you're hearing more talk it's being amplified in the media, in social media, separating us and them. People are trying to gather their communities and they're trying to figure out who's us and who's them. And some of the us's and them's are built along religious and ethnic lines, but I think they're also along lines of philosophy, I think conspiracy theorists are coalescing around each other, around people like Andrew Wakefield, who is still going around saying that MMR vaccine causes autism,
right,
even though
right.
he lost his medical license, and he has found kindred spirits in conservative America right now. He's relocated to Texas and he's become a darling there, and he's not alone. He's aided and abetted by Russian bots. And they're trying to sow discontent and disbelief over the effectiveness and safety of vaccines. You know, maybe sending out messages that say, only rich people get the good vaccine. You're probably getting the lousy one that they wouldn't give to animals, or and stuff like that. But then the question is, why do those messages resonate? They resonate, I think, when you've got people who are under stress, as I think many people are, and the stress comes from stress over security or fear over security. The security may be, security regarding your life, the defense of borders, the perception that people are going to come and take your lifestyle away from you, precarious employment, precarious economy, precarious housing for some people, and I think the failure of modern democracies to take care of everybody, take care of the largest number of people, and instead of relying on bromides and capitalist philosophies that may have worked decades ago, they have begun to fail. I think there's a failure in liberalism today, for instance, to articulate a vision for people who have lost their jobs, who have found that they don't know where they fit into the economy anymore. There's a lot of 40 and 50 something men who, for instance, who have no idea who they are or what contributions they have to make. Well, if that's how you feel, then you're going to be fearful that you're going to lose what you've got. You're going to be angry. You're going to be under stress. And under those conditions, it's very hard to empathize with other people.
So anger, it's kind of a chicken egg thing to some degree, I suppose. But yeah, if you're starting out with anger, if that's your first thing, you're probably not going to bend towards treating others with kindness, respect, including embracing, and so on.
Or if you're angry that you think something's been taken away from
right,
you, and
that right.
can be fueled by that. I think politicians are very good at pushing that button. Certain politicians, fear. So
yeah,
if you've got anxiety that you're under threat, so that your fight or flight response is on fire, your adrenal glands are on fire, that's going to fire up a part of your brain called the amygdala, and the amygdala is the part of the brain that separates us ourselves into us and them, and so. You begin to see some of the connections between external or social phenomena and what's actually going on in the brain.
Context, right? I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about here to some degree. I wonder, you certainly present this beautiful argument, narrative, the personal thread and so on through story, this position that says there really is no downside to being kind, but would you say there might be? I mean, maybe there's a perceived downside, or for folks who feel like they're anxious because they're threatened, or they're living in this world of fear and anger and so on. So there's a perceived understanding that I can't be kind, therefore, because it might lead me, I might become too vulnerable, or I'll be taken advantage of, and so on.
Or here's another one, that you might be ridiculed by your in-group. That your in-group might say you're a wuss.
Right.
You don't know how to be tough. And I think there's a difference between defending borders, for instance, and making sure that the media takes photos of kids in pens.
Right.
That's just saying, look how mean we can be. That's like it's almost a shaming experience, and you can imagine that some people will not be lauded for demonstrating kindness in a moment like that. They might actually be ridiculed or laughed at. And,
well, Brian, isn't there a sense when? I want to say there's a perception that being kind is weak, and you kind of fly in the face of that. This is what good leaders do. This is what good parents do. This is what good people do. We empathize with others.
Yeah, and we have certain role models in the world. We have a president of the United States who doesn't do that. he doesn't appear to shed a tear. He doesn't appear to care about anybody other than himself. And he's the alpha male at the moment. And there are some people who believe that he makes Prime Minister Justin Trudeau look like a wuss by comparison. I'm a Trekkie. I remember the old series,
right.
the original series of Star Trek explored some very popular science fiction themes, and one of them, you know, very early on, it was an episode, I believe it was called The Enemy Within.
Oh yeah, you're a Trekkie, all right.
I am all right. Split into two Kirks, the mean Kirk, the nasty one,
right.
The one that's a bit of a sexual abuser and drinks alcohol, but is decisive. And the nice Kirk who stripped away of his and you have Spock on the side who's calling the plays, who's saying, look, fascinating to look at this human being split into two, and somehow the nice, the empathic, the kind version of Kirk is not decisive,
right?
And I think that we have that fear. I think we have that fear that strong leaders do the tough things. By the way, as I found out, as I talk about in the book, as you know, from reading the book, some strong leaders are probably what we would call successful psychopaths. And psychopaths don't have empathy. Well, they have cognitive empathy.
Well, and I wanted to bring up this idea of, and I love it, Machiavellianism. You know, you do touch on that a fair bit in the book. This I don't know if that's exactly what you're referring to, but some people are wired in a very particular way.
Yes, and they are. So if you are a member in good standing of what is referred to as the dark triad, either having a psychopathic personality disorder or a narcissistic personality disorder or a Machiavellian personality disorder, then you are challenged, certainly in the empathy department, at least as far as feeling other people's pain. It has been argued that psychopaths are excellent at cognitive empathy, and that they use that insight, that ability to imagine what it's like to be somebody else, not feel their pain, but imagine what they might be feeling and have a pretty accurate read on that, that they are able to use that to manipulate their victims into doing things that they want.
Right.
They want them to do, like give them adulation, or if they happen to be a conductor of an orchestra, contributing to the orchestra's foundation, you know, becoming major benefactors, and they're very selective at who they are kind to, who they pay attention to, and who they don't. So they, you know, the particular orchestra leader that I'm referring to, that Scott Lilienfeld talked about, conductor of a major North American orchestra, that this person was uncannily kind and attentive to benefactors, and treated his orchestra like poop. And this is of a kind that I'm certainly familiar with. I have met physicians who are amazingly kind to patients or to donors and treat colleagues, allied health professionals, poop.
It's so funny, you know, I've certainly had my, we all have had our experiences of the Canadian health system. And on one hand, you just, it's wonderful. It's marvelous. We have access and opportunity, you know, and I work in international development. So I've seen some pretty at-risk health systems, but every now and then you come out of a situation with one of those, you know, healthcare practitioners, and you think, wow, maybe you should have went into real estate
or used cars.
Yes.
That's right.
You know, yeah, I felt like I just had my oil changed today. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about that, Brian. 30 years treating patients, ER doctor. Did it chisel away at your empathy?
Yeah, it did. And I would say that there was for me a big reveal. And the personal reveal was that I think it came as much from the mistakes I made as being told by a family once that I was very unkind, And that one hit me.
Yeah, that's got to be hard.
Yeah, in large part because patients and families may not know medical competence when they see it. You know, they may be able to argue it. Maybe they have a physician in the family. I can always argue that physician that they know who's telling them that they should sue could be doing it for all kinds of other unkind reasons, like Schadenfreude for a colleague, or maybe an opportunity to appear to be the hero to the family, you know, implying without actually saying it that had they been the doctor in charge, that this mistake would not have happened. But when a family calls you unkind, there's a better than average chance that they've got a handle on kindness, and they've seen a side of you that maybe you're not happy that has poked through.
What's fascinating to me is that you received it.
Yeah.
That the soil was fertile.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by that for a variety of reasons, because so many of us would probably just sort of respond with more unkindness, right?
Or defensiveness, which is what I had been, and I guess I was in the right mood. Maybe I, you know, and I had enough of an adult, you know, because your first reaction, you're reeling when you receive a letter like that, and I did. This was a multi-page
letter. Yeah.
Beautifully written, and it was it was laser-like, and it was true. But I spoke to my chief. Either he or I first noticed that this letter was not sent to the regulator. It wasn't sent to the College of Physicians and Surgeons or the State Medical Board. It was sent to me.
Right.
So they were trying to reach me. When you send a letter to the college, you're trying to hold my feet to the fire and make me uncomfortable and afflict the comfortable. Whereas this was, they were trying to reach out to me. And I was fortunate enough, I guess, to receive the message. Somewhere along the line, I decided that that the worst thing that people can do, human beings can do to each other, is to be bothered by somebody else's behavior and never tell them. The tyranny of the silence.
There's a responsibility there, right? We're back to choice.
Yeah. So they wimped out, and what does that tell you? That tells you that they are, they think that expressing their opinion, first of all, it's not just that this is how I feel, but that's true. I'm about to deliver the universal truth to you.
Mm.
I remember as a kid, somebody said, "How come nobody likes you, Goldman?" I mean, that was said to me when I was about 14 years old.
Wow.
And why would I still remember that as if it was yesterday? Well, you know, maybe it's a little thing called shame that Brené Brown talks about.
Yeah.
She's a wonderful author who has written extensively about shame, but she tends to write from the perspective of a woman she is a woman, but also that women have a monopoly on shame.
Right.
And that men have no shame, and there are all kinds of cultural reasons that might be true, that women may be more shame prone than men, but I'm a shame prone guy, and it was the way I would beat myself up over errors. I'm around all kinds of people in medicine, in journalism, yes, where they make mistakes, but they don't act as if they've killed somebody.
Right.
When they make a mistake,
right.
Some are more perfectionistic than others.
Right.
Some are very perfectionistic and others aren't. But in medicine, there is a predilection for perfectionism.
And it's understandable, right? I mean,
Really? So yeah, you yeah, mean understandable yeah, in the sense yeah. that well, of course they should never make a mistake. But where does that come from? And I think that perfectionists drift into medicine because many of them are shame prone. Many of them are hoping that if they do enough good work, and of course this is all unvoiced, unspoken, because most of them would never see a psychiatrist, because if they did, then that would stigmatize them. They would show that they're weak. I believe, this is just my opinion, that the shame-prone people in healthcare went into healthcare to do enough good works to try to throw the monkey of shame off their back. And of course, it doesn't happen, because as soon as they get caught out making a mistake, watch, by the way, watch the defensiveness of healthcare professionals. I didn't do that. I didn't do that. No, it was his fault. You know, or that I and or in a really tough voice, they give you 70 reasons why you're wrong.
Right.
Instead of hearing it.
Right.
They don't want to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. Proudly determined. Yes.
And families, and that's back. That's, and when families have a medical mistake and they meet the hospital's rolling their eyes because they've already labeled the family a complainer. If they're having a meeting, they've probably already labeled the family as complainers, and that's like the second act of unkindness, the second injury after the medical error. And you know, the book for me began as an examination of empathy in healthcare,
right.
and that's what I pitched, and the publisher, I think, wisely said, that's too narrow. Why don't you go out into the world?
Yes. See what's going on out there. Collect some stories. We've barely scratched the surface. We're gonna have to wrap it up in a couple of minutes. But we haven't talked about neuroscience. We haven't talked about what is a story over science have to tell you. Where is truth to be found? And it sounds to me like it's almost. I mean, it sounds trite to say truth is found in the anecdote, but in a sense, that's kind of what's going on here. And I love that about what you've done and how you've stepped out into the world to learn more about empathy. Is it fair to say that part of the reason the soil was fertile for you is that the letter was written in, well, you use the phrase laser focus, it was a kindly written letter about your unkindness?
Yeah, you know, I think it was. I think it's fair to say that I think you're bang on. I think that there are many definitions of kindness.
Mm.
And one definition is when someone actually takes the time to point out that your shoelaces aren't tied properly, or that you don't understand. You've got a lot of gifts, but you're also coming across like this. And I think a lot of us don't take the risk of saying that to somebody else because we're afraid that we're wrong. We're afraid that it's going to have a bad reaction.
Right.
And this man, the husband of this patient, was not afraid. He was fearless. He was also in pain and grieving. And he needed to have, I guess, some closure. He also needed to know that at the very least, you know, the circumstances surrounding his wife's death, at the end stage of a degenerative disease, that to give it more meaning, that it would have more meaning if somehow that experience had a lasting impact on the doctor, and it did.
And isn't it beautiful that he stepped out, that he took the risk, and look what it leads to, right? I just love that. That incremental power to change.
And David, yeah, and I'll say one more thing about that. You know, of all the people I met, Theodore Fontaine, Ted Fontaine, survivor of Indian residential schools, two of them in Manitoba, who suffered, you know, unspeakable horrors, unspeakable abuse. Had, you know, was an alcoholic, is an alcoholic, and yet pulled himself up by his bootstraps, overcoming PTSD and alcohol use disorder to become a leading light in his community, the author of his own book about his experiences, and when I went through the experience, like he's the mentor to the spiritual advisor and the indigenous advisor to a project in Manitoba called Embodying Empathy. So this is taking funding from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to create a virtual version of an Indian residential school. Now, I went through a prototype of that school, and I had a flashback to the day I had the strap. I got the strap as an 8-year-old. And the thing that I will never forget is that I told this story to Ted Fontaine after I had interviewed him. And it was a big risk because I was apologizing as I said it. He could have said, you know, go away, whatever, so you had the strap. That's nothing compared to what my people have experienced. Instead, he empathized with me.
Mm.
He went out of his way to empathize with me. And the thing that I've learned is that it doesn't matter how much pain people have experienced. You have the you're at the crossroads, David. You can either be consumed by that pain, or you can use it to empathize with others.
Yeah, it's so good.
And that's what he did, and that's my mission too.
And what's beautiful too about that, and then maybe this is where we can wrap. I've got so many more questions. I think we need to do a part two for sure. But this idea that you show us that we're wired, you know, scientifically wired to empathize with one person at a time, but you also show us through story, through other experience, and stepping out into the world that this is also true, that this is how we can actually change the world. You don't need the many; focus on the one.
Yeah, and in fact, as that's one of the criticisms from that wonderful book Against Empathy, which you know, that's also out in the air right now, that you can't empathize with the people,
right?
That's the Achilles, that's one of the Achilles heels of empathy, Paul Bloom's book Against Empathy, that you can't empathize with the people. So if you have a persecuted people, you can only empathize one person at a time. It's not the Achilles heel. It's a limitation of empathy, but it also tells you that it's the way to achieve empathy.
Right,
and
right.
If you achieve it, connect with somebody one person at a time, then you can change your life and you can change their life, and then watch them pay it forward and watch the ripple effect over the months and years and decades.
Well, I think the letter leading to the your book and your project and what you're doing is evidence of that. And thanks for your time today, Brian. We've been talking to Brian Goldman about his new book, The Power of Kindness, Why Empathy is Essential in Everyday Life. Am I a kind soul is the question that we should be waking up reflecting on tomorrow morning. Thanks so much for your time today, Brian.
You're welcome, David. Nice talking to you.